The scale of the problem is huge. We've got till 2050 by the obligations under the Climate Change Act to get our emissions down by 80% from what they are now. And we don't know how to do that in total.
When you look at the diagram that shows you where we've got to be by 2050, it rather looks like it's one of those diagrams that says, and a miracle happens here.
The UK's carbon footprint, 2% of the world's carbon footprint, it's a waste of time for us to do things when China and India are growing at an exponential rate. But when you really look at the UK in terms of what we import, it's 15% of the global CO2 emissions, so it is quite significant.
The carbon footprint of the NHS is massive. It's 21 million tonnes of CO2 equivalent in 2007 for the whole of the NHS in England.
The conundrum is that they have a large number of buildings built in the 60s and 70s, which are serious gas guzzlers.
Will exceed 2 degrees C average temperature rise globally as a result of climate change.
The temperature projections show that whatever we do now, we have locked in a rising temperature over the next 20 years or so, and it's going to get worse beyond that if we don't do something fairly radical.
The NHS is going to have to operate in a warmer climate in the future, and it's going to have to be able to do that whilst reducing its carbon. Now, that's going to be a major challenge because it gets really hot on some of the wards at the moment, let alone what that might be like in 10, 20, 30 years' time.
In hospital wards, one has to keep the temperatures within rather narrow ranges because patients may well be particularly sensitive to temperature, either because they're ill or because they're receiving drug therapy, which compromises their thermoregulatory system.
What we find in high heat periods is that the systems are running flat out, so we now have to go out and hire portable air conditioning units for very key specific areas of the hospital.
And air conditioning will simply exacerbate the energy demand and the CO2 emissions.
If you don't do anything to the building fabric and you start installing air conditioning plant, you're on a race to the death with the climate, really, because the demand for cooling is going to ratchet up dramatically.
For the NHS to achieve their stretching target of 80% by 2050, buildings has very much got to be part of that programme.
For a long time, there's been very much an emphasis on reconstruction, partly to do with image, but also, of course, the pace at which medical technology and procedures have evolved.
The last government's plan for the NHS was to demolish it and build a suite of spectacular new hospitals. But of course, the 2008 economic collapse has meant those days are over.
We're going to be mostly in the world of refurbishment now, and we're going to have to look at how we can make best use of the stock that we've got to make it fit for purpose.
It's not that we actually need more buildings, we just need better buildings, buildings that are fit for purpose, fit for the future.
The NHS estate comprises something like 30 million square metres, 18 million square metres, which is in acute hospitals. So it is vast. It's rumoured to be the biggest estate of buildings under one broad ownership in the world.
It's got a stock that ranges from all sorts of ages. Most of it is very old and very difficult to deal with.
And around 20% predate the formation of the NHS in 1948.
What we've discovered is that the industry approaches to refurbishment are extraordinarily dull and uninteresting. The important thing is to understand the problems that the existing buildings have, to be rational and scientific about it, which slightly goes against the designer ethos, but is entirely complementary.
If there's any kind of business that needs to be really careful about disruption and intervention into its daily life, it must be the NHS. You know, where all the complexities of the consequences of noise and dirt and so on.
The environments within an acute hospital that are very, very sensitive because the occupants have very reduced immunity and are generally fragile is a relatively small proportion of the overall volume of a large hospital. So in a sense, this anxiety dealing with those vulnerable shouldn't really dominate the environmental control strategy of the whole huge hospital.
If we don't do anything about making these buildings more resilient, I think the temperature problems inside for patients and staff will become more of an issue.
So the Trust in Leicester has started to show us what intelligent refurbishment can achieve.
The hospital building stock dates back from 1968 to 2000, and most of the systems we've installed wouldn't be able to cope with the massive temperature change that the climate change forecasts are giving us at the moment.
Within a neonatal setting, ambient temperature is actually a very important part of what we try and achieve within the environment there.
Neonatal babies are very prone to losing temperature. They've got a very large surface area to their body mass.
A lot of babies will be looked after within incubators, so they can actually manage their temperature within those, but not all of them. A number of babies will still be in open cots. So you have to ensure the ambient temperature is appropriate for those babies.
So we target between 26 and 28 degrees in a neonatal unit with a flexible band of about 5 degrees.
This machinery that you're working with will dissipate a lot of heat, and it can become very uncomfortable. And certainly in the old unit, where we were in very small rooms, with a lot of people working there and a lot of machinery going, the temperatures could get very high and very uncomfortable.
There were days when it was recorded in the 90s in the rooms that we're working in, which obviously isn't acceptable.
And in the winter, they'd drop and you'd be very cold at night time. It could become very, very cold, and you'd end up putting heaters into rooms as well.
If they get cold, that has a very severe effect on them clinically. They become very unwell very quickly.
The building is in use 24 hours a day in the delivery context, that ladies are coming in at any time to deliver babies.
Knocking down the building wasn't an option. The other services had no need to be upgraded. We were only looking at providing a new neonatal unit, which needed one floor of this building.
We could have done something on the windows here, couldn't we?
Now, looking back, we've pretty much got everything we wanted.
It is as we wanted it to be, recognising the constraints, as say, of working within a limited footprint rather than having a brand new PFI build.
What we've got is a 21st century fit-for-purpose neonatal unit, and we've got it now. It really is a unit that I'm very proud of.
So the Leicester neonatal refurbishment really shows how part of a building can be transformed incrementally without closing down the rest of it. And our research has been looking at how whole buildings can be similarly refurbished and made more resilient to summertime overheating.
Our project has the ugly acronym DDREC, Design the Delivery of Robust Hospitals in a Changing Climate. It's highly applied, so we're not interested in wishy-washy intentions. We want to get into the nitty-gritty of what you might do to particular building types.
When you look across the NHS estate, you can see the same types of buildings occurring again and again. Nightingale pavilions, matchboxes on muffins, low-rise nucleus-type courtyard buildings from the 1970s. All of those come up time and time again. And when we chose the case studies for this particular research project, we were very lucky that across our partner trust estates, we had examples of all of those.
So our challenge in the project was to understand how we could make hospital buildings more resilient to climate change without simply increasing the resulting CO2 emissions.
We select candidate buildings, which we think that at least 100 across the NHS estate. We fill them up with sensors for, and we've done this for 2 years, so we get two complete cycles of seasons, and we find out all about how they perform.
We measured the internal temperature, and simultaneously we acquired records of the external weather conditions, so that we could understand the relationship between external temperature and external solar radiation and the consequential internal temperatures. And by knowing those two things, we can either calibrate computer models which predict internal temperature. So we build a model of the hospital space, we expose that computer model to the known climate, and hopefully it reproduces the measured internal temperature. And we can tune the model so that it accurately reproduces what we measured. Having done that, then we can use that model to project forward in time as the climate changes to see what would happen with the building as it is now if nothing was changed. And we made projections for 2030, 2050 and 2080.
We've had this terrific opportunity because we've had 3 years and a good funding base to think much more speculatively than the construction industry and designers in practice could ever do. They don't have that luxury.
Adam Brooks Hospital was reconstructed on the outskirts of Cambridge from the end of the 1950s. And the earliest stages of the new hospital were arranged as low-rise outpatient buildings. But the main inpatient accommodation was built as a 10-storey ward tower above a building containing operating theatres and other ancillary facilities. And that combination of a tall slab and a low-rise building is known as the matchbox on a muffin. And that's a classic type of post-war National Health Service hospital.
The original tower is south-facing, and this is an oddity. Florence Nightingale was very clear that hospitals should face east and west. And it does raise the stakes, particularly in hot summers, as sunshading was left out of the original design. The tower has a clever concrete structure with flush ceiling slabs. That means there are no beams sticking down into the space, offering a lot of flexibility and potential for refurbishment. The building is uninsulated, but that's relatively easy to deal with in a refurbishment exercise. The facade is very simple. It's made of precast concrete panels and glass. The windows were all replaced in the 1990s as they were across the NHS for safety reasons. The openings were restricted to only 100 millimetres, and that's dramatically reduced the ventilation rates achievable, a wholly unintended consequence. So hospital buildings have become much more vulnerable to summer overheating. The original design incorporated innovative and efficient radiant ceilings, comprising perforated metal panels with water pipes welded onto them. The building has a substantial plant room at the top, full of mechanical kit, supplying air only to the wards below. There's no organised extract at all, but the building leaks air like a sieve, which lowers peak temperatures in the summer. But by the late 2030s, the outside air will be too warm.
Using our computer models, we discovered that, for example, the tower block in a typical year would start to get uncomfortably warm, as judged by the criteria used in the NHS, by 2030. But in a hotter year, a year that's only exceeded in 1 year in 10, that tower block is already not meeting the thermal comfort standards of the NHS.
The simulations show peak temperatures of 30 degrees centigrade in 2005, rising to 34.8 in 2050 and beyond. So out of the research, we've looked at these five or six principal building types across the NHS. We've diagnosed the data from them, and we've come up with various schemes. In the case of Adam Brooks Hospital, we have five options. Option one pursues the industry standard scheme, that's to say what an enlightened contractor might deliver. This is, in effect, the passive house model, a way of making very low energy houses translated into the world of public buildings. You put a duffel coat around the building, you super insulate it, which is great in winter, but increasingly problematic in warming summers. You seal all the windows. You may well be persuaded to increase their performance, although that's more expensive. The classic passive house strategy actually reduces the area of glazing, as it's seen to be the weak link. And then you pump air into it, and pump air out through a very efficient heat exchanger. It's a strategy for cold climates, but makes the summer cooling problem more acute, certainly in the southern half of Britain.
But the net result of that was it pushed the energy demand for heating in winter, cooling in summer, and for fan energy to ventilate up to around about 101 gigajoules per 100 cubic metres per year. Now, the NHS has a target of between 55 and 65 gigajoules per 100 cubic metres.
Because option one is mechanically cooled, it could be controlled to never overheat until late in the 21st century, but at a cost in energy and in missing the carbon reduction commitment by an increasing amount. The next option, option two,
attempts to save more energy. It modifies option one by substituting radiant heating and cooling for blown air, which saves some energy input. And option two also seals the windows, but in addition, adds sun shading. These take the form of vertical kite shapes, fabricated in aluminium mesh, which cast useful rectangular shadows on the glass, but maintain the high-angle daylight that provides useful light in the winter. The air is mechanically exhausted back to a heat exchanger, but the walls are cooled not by blowing in cooled air, but by radiant ceiling panels. It achieves 45 gigajoules per 100 cubic meters in building energy performance, and if you add on the 40-odd for hospital occupancy, we achieve 85 to 90 overall. But that's still unacceptably high compared to the Department of Health target of 55 to 65 gigajoules per 100 cubic meters. Option 3 is a true hybrid scheme. That's to say, it mixes natural and mechanical ventilation as required. This option retains the current double glazing units, and it enables all of the windows to be opened by occupants in peak summer periods, so a high degree of occupant control contributes to this option's overheating defense strategy. In addition, the suspended ceilings are cut back as far as the supply ductwork allows in order to expose the concrete slabs, which offers a bit more radiant cooling in summer. Perimeter heating is introduced by incorporating elementary fin tubes with low-pressure hot water in a protective casing. And in some ways, the services strategy is similar to that in the existing building. Option 3 has the capability of mechanically cooling itself for the time being, so by the 2030s, peak temperatures can be held to 27.2 degrees centigrade and by 2050, 27.3, but again, at a cost in energy and carbon. Option 4 incorporates natural cross ventilation and perimeter heating, and this option dispenses with the mechanical ventilation system altogether. It upgrades the external envelope to the standard of options 2 and 3, and provides perimeter heating with actuated trickle vents below fully operable occupant-controlled windows. Each floor can be cross-ventilated by threading crossover ducts in alternating directions across the width of the floor plate. The option envisages active use of night ventilation, and it removes all of the suspended ceilings to expose the full flat concrete soffit above all of the patients. And the aim is that vigorous night ventilation will cool the ceilings down. Loughborough University's computer simulations clearly show there were no predicted hours above the comfort thresholds, and the annual predicted energy demand was 20 gigajoules per 100 cubic metres. With the addition of about 40 gigajoules for the hospital function, this option falls well within the Department of Health energy target for refurbishment. Option 5 pursues the principle of natural ventilation explored in option 4, but reinforces it with stacks to develop greater pressure differences. The stacks provide much greater predictability as to where all the air is going. In hospital, where the avoidance of the spread of airborne infection is clearly very important, reversing flow regimes are unacceptable. This option removes the outer walls of a floor at mid-height to provide a free air environment in which the stacks ventilating the lower four floors can terminate. And the stacks are strictly dedicated to one space per cell. No air passes from one space through another before it leaves the building. The deep stacks on the elevation reduce the glazed area to lessen solar gain, and the depth also shades the glazing through the critical summer overheating period. All the windows can be opened, and the cross ducts of option 4 are introduced below a fully exposed concrete ceiling. And here the intention is to night ventilate vigorously, but within the comfort parameters of sleeping patients and patrolling staff. For this final option, there were no predicted hours above each of the comfort thresholds, and the annual predicted environmental energy demand, a mere 32 gigajoules, which, with the addition of the hospital function figure, brings this option to the upper end of the department's target. In fact, the energy calculation relates to the floor above the missing floor with greater heat losses, so the final energy demand figure would be considerably lower approaching that of option 4. It is emerging from the research that the hospital building types vary considerably in their resilience, but one of the most effective is in fact one of the oldest established.
The classic 19th century hospital type, of which there's still a fair number in use, is known as the Nightingale Pavilion. This type consists of long wards arranged as fingers projecting out from a circulation spine or corridor. That type has its origins in the 18th century, but became particularly popular after the middle of the 19th century because it was advocated by the nurse Florence Nightingale as being the best way to achieve good ventilation in hospital wards, preventing cross-infection. And Bradford Royal Infirmary, constructed from 1927, is one of the last complete examples of that type.
This is a typical Nightingale ward design. It's had very little redevelopment since it was designed originally. And the original features that were retained here are a timber plank floor, the high ceilings, and of course the whole of the ward is in an open area with beds either side, radiators behind the bed, and would also have a vent, and that would assist in the ventilation regime, which is natural ventilation.
If you go back before 1946, to pre-war, late Victorian, late 19th century buildings, all of which are scheduled for demolition or conversion into apartments or whatever, you find that those buildings are particularly resilient to hot summer conditions because they've got so much thermal mass in them and they've got nice high ceilings, and because in those days architects knew how to make buildings comfortable, they oriented them properly, the windows are very sophisticated in terms of opening patterns, and these are manageable environments, so we've got very good data.
The ward blocks at Bradford remain pretty much as they were originally designed. Large open dormitory-style ward spaces in many cases. They're arranged east and west, as per Nightingale's original stipulations. The roofs have had a little bit of insulation added in recent years, but the walls are essentially unchanged, solid with a stone exterior and some rubble infill. The windows, however, have been altered, and quite significantly, with the sophisticated original opening pattern having been removed, new double glazed windows installed with a much reduced opening area. And below the windows, the original air bricks, which allowed a constant flow of air, have been blocked up.
The Nightingale Hospital, which is more thermally massive, we found would remain comfortable out to 2050 in a typical year, and would only just start to feel a little warm, as currently designed, in a hot year by 2030. They're really rather energy efficient because they don't have any mechanical ventilation system. So you don't have any fan energy and you don't have to pre-warm that air that you're blowing around the building.
So we've already seen that Nightingale wards are quite thermally comfortable, so we're quite interested in Nightingale wards. We've been carrying out a study in Leeds related to this project, where we've been using carbon dioxide as a tracer gas to explore potential for infection risk and look at ventilation rates in a Nightingale ward. We were achieving between 3 and 6 air changes an hour on most occasions in those wards. And we were also finding that the air in those wards was quite well mixed. If you were in there, the infection risk is the same for everybody. There's no hot spots.
For the Bradford Royal Infirmary, we've developed 3 options, from the industry standard option to one that's rather more radical.
So one of the options that we looked at for the Nightingale hospitals was to improve the ventilation, which in some circumstances involved unblocking apertures which have been blocked up over time, and providing shading to the windows.
In the current climate, the computer simulations predict that the existing Nightingale building would reach 33.2 degrees centigrade, but the measures in option 1 reduce that to 31.2 degrees. By 2030, option 1 would reduce peak temperatures to 28.4 degrees centigrade. And by 2050, option 1 would peak a little higher at 28.9. But by 2080, option 1 is so resilient, the peak actually reduces marginally to 28.5 degrees centigrade. Option 2 develops the measures in option 1 adding insulation to the walls and roof, but introduces low-wattage, low-velocity ceiling fans to lower further the temperatures perceived by patients within the ward.
And extend, as it were, the life of the hospital right into the 2080s.
Option two, in the current climate, is calculated to deliver a peak temperature of 30 degrees centigrade. By 2030, option two would reduce peak temperatures to 27.2 degrees centigrade within all of the comfort thresholds. And by 2050, option two could hold temperatures to 27.7 degrees centigrade. By 2080, the inherent resilience of the modified Nightingale building, boosted by the action of the fans, will drop peak temperatures to only 27.3 degrees centigrade. Option three has the same insulation standards and shading as the other options, but seals all the windows. 100 millimeter diameter air inlets are inserted above each bed space, with a simple convective heating device to enable supply air to be preheated or recirculated within the ward. Primary heating cooling is delivered through the installation of radiant heating panels. The addition of radiant cooling eliminates entirely the risk of overheating, but at a cost, a greater energy consumption. Option three, being mechanically cooled, remains within comfort thresholds at just above 27 degrees centigrade all the way through until 2080.
It's demonstrated just how resilient the traditional Nightingale wards at Bradford are as a building type. That's not particularly surprising, however, because Nightingale's original ideas were all about using the physical fabric of the building, the actual stuff of the architecture, to create an appropriate internal environment.
The general limitations of a space like this are that it doesn't accord with the current thinking of Darcy's report, which specifically is to provide healthcare space which accords with privacy and dignity requirements.
We explored five alternative layouts for the Nightingale wards plus the original open ward. And in each case, we used computational fluid dynamics simulation to explore the air flows in these spaces. But what we did find in pretty much all of the layouts we looked at was that we could redesign the internal layout and still ensure that we had good ventilation for patients, which gives us a real option for using these Nightingale wards into the future.
We are producing almost quasi-construction drawings for the adaptation schemes. So you could take one of our schemes off the shelf and pretty much implement it and be fairly confident about the cost. Per square metre for all of the adaptation schemes, they vary between £900 and £1,600 per square metre. That is very considerably less than the cost of a new building and completely in line, and rather less actually, than NHS standard refurbishment costs. If you rode in to the necessary backlog maintenance, which is largely health and safety driven, you would have a perfectly reasonable meter cost. One of the surprising things about the adaptation schemes is that they're all mitigation schemes as well. They save a lot of carbon energy, particularly the completely naturally driven ones. So there's everything to play for.
If we choose to stick our heads in the sand, then we'll really regret it, because it's going to be increasingly difficult to make that transition when we're forced to do it.
All of this stock, if we don't recognise how much there is to do and the time it will take to do it, it could suddenly become obsolescent or spectacularly expensive to treat or unusable. None of those are good things. We need to get on with the right thing now.
And very sadly, the mortality rate rises very rapidly as the numbers of over-hot days start to increase.
Why demolish a facility that has poor functional suitability and poor space utilisation when it can be modified? The embedded carbon in developing new facilities is far greater than that which would be embedded within a refurbished facility.
Refurbishments are much quicker than new builds, and in most of our schemes, you can keep some kind of activity going on at least part of the building throughout, so there's a continuity there.
Refurbishment is more important than ever in making the best use of the money that the National Health Service has got to improve the buildings that it's got, both so that they are more resilient, but also so that they use less energy.
If we do sustainable development well within the NHS, we will help improve the health of a population, and we'll actually make savings now that can be used in health services immediately.
The big surprise has been how easy it is to win, how, to some extent, how little you need to do to buildings to transform their performance, which is, I think, a source of huge optimism.